Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Hakeem Jeffries is one of the most powerful Democrats in Washington, and he's got a lot going on right now. Democrats will no longer control the White House, the Senate, and they missed taking the House by an oh-so-thin margin. But the newly re-elected minority leader has his eye on the future. On the future of Congress, America, and even democracy itself. That's the focus of a new book he's written and called The ABCs of Democracy. And Hakeem Jeffries joins us now. Welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Great to be on with you.
Congratulations on your re-election as minority leader. We're going to get into the election aftermath in a minute, but you're coming to Columbus on Sunday to the Ohio State Student Union, and you're going to be in conversation with your brother, Hassan Jeffries, who is also here.
Hey, Ann. Hey, Hakeem. What's up, man?
And I wanted to ask, what inspired you to write this book? It's a picture book, but it's really a picture book for adults, or at least that was my impression.
Well, that's correct. You know, it's an illustrated book for people of all ages, and hopefully will become accessible to younger Americans and children as they get older and able to process sort of the country that we live in, the greatest democracy in the history of the world, the moment that we're in. And can think about the values that have made America a great nation, and that in a turbulent moment like this will continue to give us the ability to march toward a more perfect union. The book really captures the ABCs of democracy values that I articulated in my first speech as House Democratic leader back on January 7th of 2023. And over the months that followed, I would encounter people all across the country, many of whom suggested that they'd like to see the speech that was delivered, the values that were articulated, put to paper in ways that could hopefully be processed by others who weren't able to experience the remarks that I delivered. And eventually I was persuaded that that was a good idea and decided that the best way to do it was to use both the lens of the alphabet and the power of illustration to try to bring these classic American values to life for the American people.
Yeah, so it goes through each letter of the alphabet. It's got things like hopefulness over hatred, inclusion over isolation, working families over the well-connected, and a little bit of snark, maturity over Mar-a-Lago. How did you land on each letter? I feel like each letter is designed to spark a different conversation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I began sort of with American values over autocracy to lay the foundation. Democracy over demagogues, the Constitution over the cult. So some of these values are contrasting what has made America the greatest democracy in the history of the world and contrasting that with the ugly underbelly that some would like to bring about in terms of taking us into a different direction. Other values relate more to the economics of the moment. I talk about economic opportunity over extremism, and as you pointed out, and a working families over the well-connected. And I think one of the most powerful messages that emerged from this election was the notion that everyday Americans across the country, in urban America or rural America, small-town America, the heartland of America, the Great Lakes states, Appalachia, have all said that they've had enough with the deck being stacked against them and that we have to lower the high cost of living. We have to make sure everyone has access to the American dream. We have to put working families over the well-connected individuals who are constantly knocking on Washington's door, trying to get tax cuts from themselves to the exclusion of helping everyday Americans out.
In the introduction to your book, you reference what the country was experiencing in November of 2022, when, and you wrote about a country in the midst of an identity crisis. Do you think we're still in the midst of that identity crisis today?
I think so. You know, certainly in the House of Representatives, where we fell a few seats short of taking back the majority, but basically fought the Republicans to a draw. And I think the message that comes out of this election, as we see it in the House, is that the American people want us to try to work together to get things done and to solve their core problems and not bend the will to, for instance, far-right extremism. And so we are in the midst of being at a fork in the road. We are going to have to figure out which direction we choose. Certainly, I think what the book tries to illustrate is that these core American values that I laid out through the lens of the alphabet, but these core American values are what have been an important part of our journey for the last 248 years. And as we approach our 250th birthday on January 4th of 2006, just about 18 months away, these are values that I think if we continue to lean into, we'll get through this particular electoral moment in time.
Donald Trump is actively building out his cabinet. There is a lot of conversation about who's been chosen. Obviously, the House does not confirm these members. It will be the Senate. But I do have a question related to former, I guess now former, Representative Matt Gaetz. Do you think the Speaker should release the ethics investigation to the senators?
Yes. We need full and complete transparency. I think it was former Supreme Court Justice Brandeis who said, in a democracy, sunlight is the best of disinfectants. And clearly, the senators on both sides of the aisle, and we've heard Republican senators and Democratic senators say, we want access to the report as part of our constitutional responsibility to figure out whether this particular nomination, whether he's qualified to serve as the nation's top law enforcement officer. And I don't think it's a close question. Now, the Ethics Committee is going to meet at about 1 p.m. today to consider this question, and we'll see what decision they make. And then we'll have to process the path forward thereafter. But clearly, the American people and the Senate deserve full and complete access to all of the available information so that the vetting that the American people deserve can happen. This is an incoming administration that promised America the very best economy, the very best border security, and the very best administration. And we've got to ask the question, is this the best that America can do for the Department of Justice or for the other positions where you've seen some unconventional nominations, like with respect to Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? Clearly, this is not the best that we can do.
There's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking going on about what Democrats should or should not have done, what Harris should or should not have done. We're going to get into a lot of that with your brother in just a moment. But how are you moving forward? What are you really taking away from this election?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing my brother's observations, so I'll know the type of questions that he's expected to ask me on Sunday. But really looking forward to that conversation that we'll have on Sunday and hearing your conversation a little later on this morning. But my view is that clearly the American people have indicated that they want decisive action to address the high cost of living. And the fact that so many everyday Americans, so many people in the middle class, so many people who aspire to be part of the middle class, so many working class Americans are struggling to live paycheck to paycheck and are struggling to get ahead and can barely get by. Now, this situation has been exacerbated by the post-pandemic inflation that hit the United States of America and countries all across the world, but it actually is a situation that has existed for decades in America, where the middle class and those who aspire to be part of it haven't made progress. There's actually been retrenchment. And that can be explained by a variety of different things: poorly negotiated trade deals, the outsourcing of good-paying American jobs going in the wrong direction as opposed to being created in the United States of America, the dramatic decline of unionization that has been underway in America for decades, and, of course, the rise of automation, which does have some consumer benefits, but it costs good-paying American jobs as well. All of these forces have been conspiring against the necessary growth that we need to have a stable democracy and a strong middle class. And the American people, I think, have said enough. And that, to me, is the message that we have to take away from this election, whether you're a Democrat, Independent, or Republican. And it's going to require all of us to work together, as we are prepared to do with the incoming administration, to solve this problem for everyday Americans once and for all.
That was House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tickets are $35 to the event and include a copy of his new book, The ABCs of Democracy. There is a link to buy tickets on our website, wosu.org/allsides. This is a partnership event with Gramercy Books and Ohio State's History Department, and they're making 400 free tickets available to students. So if you are a student, you can go and get yourself a free ticket to the event. I want to turn now to the other brother, Hassan Jeffries. He is a professor of history here at The Ohio State University. He's the author of numerous books, the host of the Hard History podcast. Thank you so much for coming back.
It's always great to be with you.
So, you know what your brother said is something interesting, and I want to tease that out. You know, he talked less about why people didn't come out for Harris and more about why people supported Donald Trump. What do you make of that, trying to understand why people wanted Trump back in office?
Well, I think my brother's right when he talks about the core issues that are concerning American people across the board, regardless of race, regardless of age, regardless of gender, regardless of where they are. I think what it really came down to was, you know, a messaging issue as it relates to information and disinformation. I mean, it is clear that, you know, some people who are making, some white men who are making $25,000 an hour have convinced some white people who are making $25 an hour that some black and brown people who are making $7.50 an hour are the reason for their economic woes. You know, that to me is I can understand the problems and the challenges that people are facing. What's unfortunate is their misunderstanding or overall misunderstanding of the cause of these problems and issues. There has been this Monday morning quarterbacking saying that, you know, so Democrats, you know, need to lean more into the working class. Like, what are you talking about? If you look at the policies and the statements, they were clear-eyed and spoke with a clear voice about the problems that were affecting the working class. So it is something going on that is much more in terms of the appeal, particularly to the white working class, because the black working class was with Kamala Harris all the way through, that has to be addressed. So, yes, there are broad issues that are affecting everyone that are of deep concerns to everyone, including these pocketbook issues. But how do people understand the nature and cause of these problems seems to be where the split is occurring.
Yeah. After the election, Googling of what is a tariff spiked.
Not which speaks to this issue of ignorance. And I don't mean that as a disparaging term. I mean it in terms of just not knowing.
Yeah.
I'm a teacher. I'm an educator, right? And we have...
That doesn't mean you're stupid.
That doesn't mean you're stupid. It means you just do not know. We should not be the day after the election Googling what is a tariff. We should not be the day after the election Googling, you know, can I change my vote? No, that's not the way it works. So there is an educational deficit that we have to work on, both as formal educators, but then also as, in this instance, the Democratic Party, to make sure that people understand not just the issue, but the nature of the issue. What are actual solutions and problems to these? Part of that challenge, though, is we live in America. And one of the most powerful political organizing tools and ideas in America is racism. And a lot of that was being deployed by the political right, and Donald Trump in particular. He made no secret of that. But people were falling back on that as the explanatory force, which moves them away from the actual factors that are hindering their life opportunities.
One of the things I find fascinating, there was also a lot of Googling about Obamacare versus the Affordable Care Act, what the Department of Education does, how federal like funding impacts things like IEPs and children with disability. And I'm like, as somebody who's covered government for the last decade, I'm like, oh my gosh, people, these are like very fundamental questions that should be addressed in a high school civics class.
And which speaks to not only that ignorance, but also the sophistication and the success of the political right to move people on messaging over policy. So the Affordable Care Act today has very high favorable ratings among Republicans. But Obamacare does not.
But it's the same thing.
But it's absolutely the same thing, right? So it's a messaging problem rather than a reality problem. But that has to be addressed. So the core policy positions of the Democratic Party, I would argue, are spot on. The question is, they need not move away from those. They just have to work on and be clear about working towards educating folks so that they understand that if you are on the Affordable Care Act, then you need to be supporting those elected officials that actually brought it to you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up, what history can teach us about this moment in politics? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Talking with a history professor can be helpful in times of transition and turmoil because no matter how bad or how great things may seem to you right in this moment, in terms of political divisiveness and polarization, it turns out things have been just as bad, if not worse, throughout our history. And that may be reassuring, maybe not. That's why we're spending this hour with historian Hassan Kwame Jeffries, a history professor here at Ohio State. He's also the author of the 2009 book, Bloody Londa, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. Professor Jeffries, you know, we were talking a little bit about why people voted for Trump and understanding that no matter who you voted for, I don't think anyone thought, oh, I'm voting against my economic interests. And I don't think a lot of people were saying, I'm voting because I'm racist. I think there needs to be a very clear conversation that most people, I would argue, when they go to the polls, are voting for the person they honestly believe will make things better.
Well, I think you're right. I think we have to take people seriously as political thinkers, no matter their political affiliation, no matter their economic status. They are, overwhelmingly, people will vote in what they understand to be their economic interest, what they understand to be their self-interest. However, in America, the way we have framed so many of these issues, and we frame so many of these issues along racial lines, then people, particularly we see this on the political right, will choose policies that are rooted in racism because they believe that in this instance, for example, immigration and right down the road in Springfield, Illinois, Haitians are taking over, right? And they're causing us, you know, to lose jobs and all these other things. Well, no, the loss of jobs, for example, and the rise in affordable housing is real. But how do you explain that, right? Becomes where is the area in which we cannot separate out sort of the racism from people's understanding. So they're not, you know, hopefully, I would say people aren't going to say, hey, I'm going to vote for this, you know, but, but that doesn't mean that a racial understanding of America isn't informing the ways in which they're making some of these decisions.
I think that's a good point. I mean, when you talk about the history of affordable housing, you have to talk about redlining. Mm-hmm. When you talk about, you know, the GI Bill that put so many Americans in homes, who could access that and who could not access that. When you talk about education, we educate by zip code. There are lots of conversations that center around how institutions work the way that they do.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's, I think, where the role of history becomes very important and understanding how we have gotten here.
But there's no bumper sticker for this.
There is no bumper. There's no easy. Well, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center has lots of nice bumpers. But the idea of like, OK, how do we understand redlining? Right. I mean, you know, we live in a society that, you know, puts an emphasis on the quick soundbite. We live in a society that is very much about sort of, you know, information in 20 seconds. And to understand actually how society works, it takes longer than 20 seconds to understanding, as you mentioned, the history of redlining and housing and school district lines and all of these things.
Even homeowners associations have like crazy origin story.
Absolutely. And to keep some people in and keep a lot of other people out. And so we look back at history. We have to understand the past so we can make sense of the present. That should be fundamental to the work that we do. And hopefully we get people, students, whether in the classroom now or lifelong learners, to understand the past so they can make better decisions, the best decisions possible for all people as we move into the future.
Speaking of moving into the future, there's already a lot of hot takes on what happened in the 2024 election. And very often I think early hot takes are not correct. I mean, for example, after the 2012 election, Republicans thought, oh, we have to pivot towards Black and brown Americans. We have to soften on immigration. And they did change their policy, just not in the way that like they talked about in 2012. And it turned out it worked for Donald Trump in 2016. What do you make of like everything from Harris was the wrong candidate to this was the wrong message? I mean, there's opinions are a dime a dozen right now.
Yeah, and time will tell sort of what, you know, what really happened. But my guess at this early stage to be a Monday morning quarterback myself on a Wednesday is that it wasn't really Harris. I mean, Harris was put into this position with 100 days to go. And she ran a phenomenal campaign, given what she was handed and what she had to do, not just in terms of how do you run a nationwide, how do you run a campaign for President of the United States in just 3 months, which we do not do when people have 2 years leading up to it, but also how do you do that following a global pandemic in which inflation has been on the rise, although it's been coming down. I mean, everything was arrayed against whoever that candidate was going to be, whether it was Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. So the issue in my mind was not Kamala Harris. I think time will tell. But there was an issue with her candidacy in the sense that you had a woman who was running and you also had a Black woman who was running. And that can't be set aside in a race that was so close. I mean, we're talking about less, you know, 50. It will probably wind up to be 49 to 48, you know, on the margins, how we perceive our candidates and who we're willing to support and vote for is really telling. You know, Democrats often get knocked for being the party of identity politics and only voting for us, particularly I hear it all the time, African Americans. You're only voting for this candidate because they're Black. Well, you know, 70 some percent of white men voted for the white man again, right? I mean, so let's be clear about whose identity is at play. I think in the end, though, and I hope as we move forward, no matter what people are saying, as they look to the political left, that they don't stray from their policies, particularly that they don't throw under the bus those who are most vulnerable. I mean, one of the things, you know, I have my own critiques about the political left and the Democratic Party and of my brother, too. but one of the things I don't want them to do is to, or one of the things I do deeply appreciate is their willingness to protect the most vulnerable among us, whether we're talking about the poor, the elderly, those without legal status, the LGBTQ community, trans folk, people of color. I don't want us to throw anybody under the bus in pursuit of two or three votes. The policies are the right policies. We just have to get people to understand why those policies will not only serve those groups, but will serve all Americans.
I listened to a talk you gave not too long ago, after the election, so really not too long ago. And you said that now the Democrats have lost the White House and the Senate, you used a phrase that you might associate with an airline crash. You said, brace for impact. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So, you know, when Trump was previously in office, nearly a million people died. Right. I mean, as we were, because of the incompetency, and I'll say the incompetency of the response to the global pandemic. You know, the election of 2020, you know, we as a nation were in a nosedive and we pulled up just in the nick of time. A lot of people were hurt. A lot of lives were lost unnecessarily. Well, we have just handed the cockpit back over to the team that was in control. And this time they seem determined, as we look at the nominees for cabinet positions, to deconstruct, to dive, to literally, you know, fly this plane into the ground. I am convinced that, you know, there are those who want to protect democracy, but there are also those who believe that democracy is the problem. And the federal government, whether we're talking about Health and Human Services or we're talking about Department of Education, is somehow the reason for all of the issues that we face. So there's going to be a lot of hurt and a lot of harm that's going to be done in the coming months, especially. And so I think, as we nosedive, we need to brace for impact. It doesn't mean that we don't get ready to sort of organize those who, you know, who are going to feel this the most, and even those who feel empathy for those who are going to feel it the most, that, you know, once that impact happens, you know, we have to be ready to respond. People have to be ready to build again. But I, you know, I am my brother's a little bit more optimistic than I am. And maybe that's because I'm a historian, and I understand that things don't always get better. The plane doesn't always soar to heights. Sometimes it does land, and sometimes it crashes. And I think we're in one of these moments where people are actively trying to crash. And that, to me, is really frightening.
Yeah, there's a lot of thought going on right now. I think that's the most benign way to put it about some of Trump's cabinet choices. He has Matt Gaetz for Attorney General, which we talked to your brother about. He has Linda McMahon of WWF fame for the Department of Education, Dr. Oz for Medicaid and Medicare, Pete Hegseth, the Fox News host, for defense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Marco Rubio, though, for Secretary of State, feels like a more traditional pick. But yeah, there's been a lot of really interesting choices, a lot of people from outside of government. A lot of people who perhaps haven't worked explicitly in the industry that they're now going to oversee.
Not only not worked explicitly, haven't worked at all. Like Linda McMahon, like, come on. Like, we're not even being serious at this point. But the charge makes sense. Like, we look at it and say, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe these are just sort of unconventional picks. If you do not believe in the existence and the purpose of these departments, then you will put anybody in there and task them with deconstructing, literally with dismantling these departments. So this is not a question of competency. This is not a question of, you know, thinking outside of the box. They're literally putting into place loyalists and people who are not interested in the mission of these departments. I must say that there was a whole lot of discussion in recent years about diversity, equity, and inclusion and what it means to be a DEI hire and black folk only being put into office and women only being put into office because of their identity. This is the most nonsense that I've seen. We're not only talking about the person, the chief executive, in terms of lacking qualifications, but in terms of these nominees. So I don't want to hear anything else from my good friends on the political right about people of color, you know, not having qualifications for being in an office when these are the people that they are rallying behind.
As a historian, what do you make of this push to do recess appointments, to get these people through and bypass the Senate? Now, to be fair, the Senate has to acquiesce, right? They've got to go out for enough time to qualify for a recess appointment.
Yeah, this is really important. It actually reflects, I think, the authoritarian impulse that people were talking about Donald Trump was carrying into this election. This idea, and my brother talks about this often, and, you know, because he's in Congress, right? He's like, you know, the Constitution is about, you know, three co-equal branches. And the notion of recess appointments to get the president's nominations through is something that Trump is advocating because he wants to bend the Senate to heel. And I hope that the Senate does not abdicate its responsibility to advise and consent. I mean, this is a constitutional prerogative, and it's critical that it does. I'm already deeply concerned about the judicial branch, and we've already seen in the cases leading up to the election that the Supreme Court is literally willing to give immunity to actions coming out of the executive. The House has already bent the knee. The Senate, clearly, if it chooses to do these recess appointments for people who are clearly unqualified, then I deeply worry about where this nation is going in terms of its embrace of authoritarianism.
We're talking this hour with Ohio State History Professor Hassan Jeffries. Him and his brother, U.S. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, will be at Ohio State this Sunday. With a partnership with Gramercy Books and the Ohio State History Department, tickets are $35 and include a copy of Hakeem Jeffries' new book, The ABCs of Democracy. There is a link to the Eventbrite on our website, wosu.org/allsides. And so you will be asking your brother a bunch of questions. The role will be reversed.
I'm just going to channel my inner you. And hopefully I do a half, I do a job that's half as good as what you do.
Oh, thank you. The event starts at 2 p.m. and you can find ticket information at wosu.org/allsides or Gramercy Books. One of the things that you have talked about, which I find fascinating, is this concept of backlash. So that with every measure of progress comes regression, sort of the two steps forward, one step back. And you talk about it after the election of Barack Obama, after Reconstruction, after, you know, perhaps the passage of the Affordable Care Act with the Tea Party. What do you think this is a moment of backlash, and what are we backlashing against?
Well, I think we as a nation, as you know, we're burdened by this myth of perpetual progress. This idea that things may have been bad once in the American past, but, you know, they always get better. We had slavery, but by golly, we fought a righteous civil war and we got over that, right? And so things always get better. But the reality is that the moments of genuine progress and progress measured by the expansion of basic civil rights and human rights to people who find themselves living in this nation, right? Like, those moments are very short. In time, right? I mean, so coming on the heels of a bloody civil war, we have Reconstruction that lasts less than 10 years, 3 or 4 years in many places, right? And then we go into this extended period of Jim Crow. We have another period of progress when we see, coming out of the civil rights movement, finally the full enfranchisement of African Americans, a more equitable immigration policy in terms of letting people in from across the nation. And then what do we see? A hard shift to the right. I mean, the Southern strategy, right? Coming out of Nixon in late 1960s, 1970s. And then most recently, what we have seen with the election of African American president of the United States, but also the expansion of basic rights, you know, for recognition of gay marriage, for example, that, you know, for many, this, again, what's the response to the expansion of rights is that many Americans, or white Americans in particular, we're talking about, feel threatened, feel that the way of life is threatened. Now, what Donald Trump did, you know, coming as he rode into office, you know, even, you know, after in 2016, was this idea of let's go back. Let's make America greater. Let's go back to some mythic period when this expansion of rights wasn't occurring. And so we've been in this response period, right, of people who are saying that these expansions of rights are moving too fast, too quickly. That's something that we've seen throughout American history. The question is, how long does that period last? How much of that retrenchment will occur? We see it with the Dobbs decision, with rolling back of the basic reproductive rights of women. I'll say this real quickly, if we have a second. You know, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Emerita, when the Dobbs decision came down, she gave a very powerful speech during a press conference in which she said, you know, never before in American history have we seen rights granted and then taken away. And I said, wait, what are we talking about here? Like, that is exactly the history of black folk, right? That is very much American history, right? The expansion of rights and then having them taken away. No right that has been given in the United States is ever guaranteed forever. So there's been this constant push, and there are moments when those forces who are trying to limit the expansion of rights win, and we're in one of those moments. The question is, where do we go from here?
Yeah, and one of the things you've talked about, which I find fascinating, is also we sometimes forget how difficult the expansion of rights has been. You make reference to an 11-year-old Joanne Bland crossing a bridge in Selma on Bloody Sunday, and that it was not the first time she crossed the bridge.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about we like to find comfort in the idea that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. This notion that
it is, and
Dr. King used to talk about it all the time, and people reference it all the time, but they don't talk about how Dr. King explained that. He said it will only bend towards justice if people are willing to exert the force necessary to bend it in that direction. If we don't have an 11-year-old Joanne Bland, you know, who's willing to attempt to cross the Selma Bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, facing off against Alabama state troopers, she's exerting that force necessary to bend the arc towards justice. We need people who are willing to stand up and say, no, this is a bridge too far, if you will. That's critical. Change doesn't happen on its own. Change doesn't happen from the top down. The significant change that we're talking about is going to have to be from the bottom up and from the outside in, putting pressure on those who are controlling the mechanisms of power to say, look, this is what we want. This is what it should be, a more expansive, more inclusive nation, one in which we're actually striving to be a more perfect union.
Coming up, we're talking about why it might actually be important to engage in political discussion this holiday season. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with historian Hassan Kwame Jeffries, history professor here at Ohio State. He's also the author of several books and the podcast Teaching Hard History. Hassan and his brother, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, will host an event this Sunday at Ohio State. So before the break, I said maybe we all want to talk politics at the Thanksgiving and Christmas tables. Why do you think it's important to engage with family and friends who disagree with you?
It's important that we just talk. There's so much misinformation, there's so much purposeful disinformation around politics, around health, that we have to try to get to the point where we can have civil conversation, civil discourse around these issues that are so important to so many people. There's real challenges, and we can talk about what are some of these challenges, but it is an absolute must. You know, I grew up in a family, and I don't think it should be a surprise, you know, that my brother entering politics is, you know, where we always talked about politics. We could not separate it. Growing up as youngsters in the 70s and 80s, as young, you know, black kids in New York, we didn't have the luxury or the privilege of ignoring politics, ignoring what was going on in New York City and in Brooklyn and in America. So, you know, we sat at the table, sometimes we had to sit quietly while the adults in the room carried on the conversation, but they were talking about it. And there were intense discussions and debates, and not everybody agreed. But, you know, we as youngsters, I think we learned something from that, right? That this isn't that, you know, the holidays were a time to come together and to have fun, but also, okay, what are you thinking, right? Because you learn something from the different perspectives. Unfortunately, so many families, and it really is heartbreaking, you know, can't have these conversations anymore. And if we can't talk with family and friends, then we certainly can't talk to strangers. And I think we have to figure out how we can have those conversations in real candid, because they're really important, especially because we know that there's so much misinformation and so much ignorance. Again, ignorance in the truest sense of the meaning, that's out there, that we have to cut through so that we can make some, I think, hopefully, some better decisions.
Yeah, my family and my in-laws, they really run the political spectrum. And one of the funny things that I have found, particularly since we moved to Ohio, and I have a lot of family here in the state who have read my reporting and listened to what I do, and some of the really conservative ones will say, you know, they'll have broad stroke criticism about the media. But then they'll say, not you. Yeah. You do a great job. I really think, like, you're good. Everybody else is terrible. And I'm like, small. We're getting there.
Right.
But it's also that idea, that mystery of, like, they get to talk to me. They know who I am. They know what I value. They know how I look at journalism, what I think about it. And that is, like, that is so humanizing. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, we did an Untangled series on redistricting ahead of the vote on issue one here. And one of the challenges of gerrymandering is that we're self-sorting in such increasing numbers. Like, we're not living with people who believe different. We're not going in social media circles with people who believe different. We're not hanging out. And if we have friends who believe different, we're choosing not to talk about it.
Well, that, to me, speaks to the importance of where we are right now, right, on the campus of The Ohio State University. Our schools, and especially our colleges and universities, are the places, even more so than our schools, because our schools reflect the demographics of our neighborhoods so often. So they remain very racially isolated. They remain very homogeneous in many instances. But our colleges, this is why that apparently a phrase of diversity, equity, and inclusion is so important. Because if we can't come together in these universities to bring the best among us of our different groups together to study, to think, to debate, to have, you know, conversation and discussion and learn from one another, then when we go out to the rest of the world, which remains as rigidly segregated and separate as it has been in American history, certainly in modern times, then we fall back into our silos. I think we need to be doubling down on making sure that we have this diverse population here, so that when we move out into the world, we bring the best of us with us.
Yeah, one of the things I've learned that always sticks with me is that Columbus City schools are just as segregated as they were pre-Brown versus Board of Ed. So we are not living with each other.
Mm-mm. We're not. And that, you know, I see it in my classes. You know, when I teach history classes, whether it's on U.S. history, African-American, civil rights, you know, kids who are coming from all over Ohio, all over the country, but even just all over Columbus, and they haven't been in a classroom together. And to see them interact and to see them come together and to see them have debates and arguments and but also understand and respect one another. I know it's possible. We just have to have a commitment to creating the space that invites people in and giving them the tools to do the work that needs to be done.
Yeah. You and I were talking during the break, and I asked this question, and I think it stuck with me a lot. Like, if you can't talk about what you believe and why you believe it with your friends, are they your friends?
You know, those conversations have to be rooted in fact, right? Like that's also, and I think as you were pointing out, to think about why do your family members, right? You know, sort of say, oh, your friends and family, like, well, we really trust you. Well, they believe what you're saying to be true, even if they disagree with what the point is. They believe what you're saying. So they accept what you're saying, the facts of what you're saying. We've gotten to a position where we can't, as a society, and it's been intentional, right, we can't agree on a common set of facts. And if we can't agree on a common set of facts, then how can we have a conversation? I've said often that, particularly on the political right with the rise of Trump, and that the politics of the political right have become like faith, and become like a religion. And one of the Abrahamic religions of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, which are all rooted in faith. And faith is the belief in the absence of fact. And so if your politics become like a faith, become like religion, there's nothing that I can present to you, a fact that I can present to you that will move you off of that belief. There's nothing I can say about Springfield, Ohio, that, you know, in fact, the Haitian community there, the immigrants there are not eating cats and dogs. You're like, nope, not true. Right. Because it's already been said. So we have to get back to the point. We can disagree about sort of the interpretation of the facts, but we can't disagree on the facts. We have to get back to that point, some common sense conversation in order to have civic dialogue.
I don't know how we do that. And I don't know that I'm going to ask you how we do that. You know, as a journalist, it's a really complicated and difficult tightrope to walk. And I will say You know, I have a lot of, I spend a lot of time thinking about that accusation of both sidesism.
Yes. And we're going to have, I think that that's not going away as we move into the new administration. You know, it's important to have alternative, you know, conflicting, competing perspectives. But on some issues, things are not equal, right? We just had here in Columbus to see this group of Nazi wannabe sympathizers walking down. Now, how are we going to cover that? Are we going to say, well, these are just people with political views? Or are we going to be like, no, these are Nazis and anti-Semitism and racism and homophobia that they embrace? That's just wrong, right? Like, I'm okay with that. Now, do they have a right? I'm also an ACLU person, of course, right? They have this right. But let's be clear about what they are doing, why they are doing it, and the harm that it creates.
Yeah, there's a whole other conversation about, look, there's a dozen of them, and it was tailor-made for social media and to go viral. And, you know, do you, when you cover it, do you give fuel to it?
Well, I think we cover and put it in context. We say that it was a small group, but why do they feel empowered, even in small numbers, to come out in this particular way? And so we have to be mindful. These types of movements start small, right? But then that social media, we know the radicalization through white supremacy on social media, particularly of young white boys and young white men, this is how it begins, right? Like, oh, they had the determination and the courage to stand up. Well, that spreads and that number begins to grow. So we have to call it out while it's still small, because like a virus, it will spread.
I did want to ask about that. You know, the number of hate crimes and hate speeches has risen over the last decade, particularly post-pandemic too, from 2016 on. I mean, I don't know what to make of it, whether it's anti-Semitism and like racism, misogyny. Like, you just see more of it. Like, there's this very crass phrase circling post-election of your body, my choice.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is sort of sick and twisted, but it also speaks to this desire to control and possess not just women, but other people. This idea, and this is, look, let's speak candidly and frankly, right? This was part of the pitch and appeal of Trumpism, right? That we particularly, is whether we're sort of Christians or white men, like, we've been told that, you know, sort of we have not found our place and footing in society, and now it's our time to reassert ourselves. That's over. Not only sort of, you know, sort of immigrants who might be coming over or poor folk, but even women. Right. Like, that to me is should be the antipathy of what it means to be American. This idea of liberty does not mean your body, my choice. Right. It means your body, your choice. This idea of what it means to come together and to have different views or hold your own particular religious views, not as we see in Oklahoma or in Texas, the imposition of the Bible and Christianity in the public school classroom. That is fundamentally, in my opinion, well, and also in the opinion of this little piece of paper called the Constitution, un-American. But we have to be clear. We have to talk about why is it so and what does that mean? We moved from, you know, you may disagree with some of the policy positions, but what Barack Obama ran on in 08 and 2012 was hope. And we had the policies, the politics of hope. And it was real powerful. 2016, let's be clear, that Donald Trump ran on the politics of hate when he came down that escalator, right? And we're still dealing in this era of the politics of hate. And that hate is expressed both in terms of racism, but also in terms of sexism and misogyny. And we see that in that expression, in the text messages that black students around the country and are receiving, talking about now it's time for you to go back to slavery. I mean, hate has become more acceptable and expressions of it. The question is, how do we respond?
We're coming down to the end of our hour with Professor Jeffries, but I do want to remind folks that you can hear more of him this Sunday. He will be giving a talk with his brother, U.S. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Tickets are $35, and they include a copy of Hakeem's new book, The ABCs of Democracy. You can find a link on our website, wosu.org/allsides. Professor Jeffries, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a great conversation.
Well, thank you for having me as well as having Akeem.
Yeah. And so we'll see you on Sunday at 2 o'clock.
And hopefully he'll listen to me, because he does not. But hopefully, you know, again, I'll channel my...
Are you the older or the younger brother?
No, I'm the younger one. I'm the younger.
That's why he doesn't listen.
That's why he doesn't listen. But it also makes me my mom's favorite. So, you know, it all balances out in the end.
That was Ohio State professor Hassan Jeffries. He's also the host of the Hard History podcast. Definitely worth checking out. I want to say thank you all for listening to All Sides. Right here, as always, on 89.7 NPR News.